it's all kind of built upon some idea of ask before you even give anything, right? So you're asking for a T12, you're asking for a rent roll so that you can give some type of firm offer. So we try to position ours as a give on the first touch.
If you have over $200,000 sitting stagnant in your bank, retirement account, or home equity, then you're literally losing money. On this show, you learn how to get that money working for you consistently and conservatively. Learn to grow your nest egg with your host, Sean Winslow. Let's dive in.
Welcome back to another Multifamily Monday episode. I'm your host, Sean Winslow, and this is the Multifamily Money Podcast. What is going on, everyone? You know the drill. Every Monday, we're bringing an episode all on multifamily apartment investing. And today I got a great guest. Before I get into that, you all know the fee. And that fee is, if you got any value from this episode or from this podcast in general, please share it with someone who you think could get value. It could be a friend, family member, colleague, just an acquaintance that comes along and wants to learn something about real estate. Please, please share. And if you haven't done so, please leave a rating or review. That's how we get to Apple's algorithm. That's how we get to more ears out there. All right, everybody. Our guest today, his name is Tommy Brandt. He resides in Tennessee, just outside of Nashville. And Tommy is an electrical engineer by trade. And he started investing in real estate when he bought his first home that he lived in, house hacked it by having a roommate, one of his former colleagues, and then renovated it while he was living there. So a little house hack with a value add component to it. And that opened his eyes to real estate. And since then, he's gone full time, left engineering about a year ago, last August, and invest in multifamily, syndicates multifamily. He also has recently purchased a lifestyle short-term rental. And what I mean by that is that he picked a location in Florida where his parents are now retired to, where he can also have a place there where he can go and live and visit occasionally. And then when he's not there, short-term rental it. And it more than pays for itself. So he gets into kind of some tips and tricks on how he did that effectively and kind of some pitfalls to look out for. That was very interesting. And then we talked about, as we all know, the market has gotten really, really tight over the last couple of years in terms of getting offers accepted. There's a lot of competition out there. And so he wanted to set himself apart. He was building broker relations, but he couldn't get anything to pencil. And the stuff he did get to pencil, everyone was making offers. You know, had like 20 offers and eventually just get up to a price where it didn't make sense anymore. So to set himself apart, he went direct to seller. And I know we've recently had some guests on here that have talked about that, but he took a different strategy. Now, I'm not going to get into that. I'm going to let him explain, but it's a really cool strategy to not only get leads, but also build really cool relationships with other investors that could potentially lead to some awesome opportunities. So without further ado, here's Tommy Brandt. Hey, Tommy, welcome to the show, my friend.
Sean, I'm pleased to be here. Huge thank you to having me on. I took a listen to some of your other podcasts before I came on here, and you've had a lot of superstars on the podcast. And so I'm humbled and honored to be on here and have an opportunity to add value to your listeners there.
Hey, Tommy. Well, thanks for taking time out of your day. And I'm sure you're going to add value just from the quick conversation we had before this. So I'm excited to get into this one. So to start, everyone loves a good origin story. So what's Tommy's origin story? Where are you from? What was life like for Tommy growing up? And how did you get into doing what you're doing today?
For sure. Yeah. So my name is Tommy Brandt. I am a recovering electrical engineer, now full-time real estate investor. And I went full-time last August. I'm based out of the Nashville market. I've been here for, thank you. I've been here for 13 years last January after graduating from Georgia Tech in 2008. And what a time to be looking for a job. So I'll just kind of leave that there.
Hey, I graduated shortly after you, so I know how that feels.
It's like 50 job applications and one person called me back.
Yeah.
And then you look at the job market today and it's a little bit different with the reductions in force going on, but I still remember it like a year ago whenever everyone was hiring, and I compare that to when I was looking for a job. And
I know, man, I started on the ground floor when I was in the financial services industry. I started like entry level job, and then probably, I don't know, 3 to 5 years down the road, the people that they were hiring for the position I was currently at where people ran out of college. So they got to skip like 3 steps. It's just because there was a completely different job market. It wasn't as tight, but yeah, I feel you on that.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah. And as far as how I got started in real estate in 2006, I'll call it an internship, if you will, but I worked for a friend's dad who was a general contractor. And so a lot of our time was spent making mobile homes rent ready. And so we'll call it light rehab, light renovation, light construction, whatever. So we're in middle Georgia. About 15% of the demographic we were servicing was post-eviction. And so we're walking into these mobile homes and it looks terrible, right? There's trash everywhere. There's used diapers in the corner. There's hypodermic needles in the other corner. And then, by the way, the utilities have been cut off for a couple of weeks and you're looking at your friend and you're like, who's going to open the fridge? Not it. And so it did a couple of things for me. So one, it built character. We'll just kind of leave it at that after going into some nasty fridges and you see some sweet potatoes that are look like they're ready to grow another sweet potato. And then the other thing it did is it gave me the vision to see past all the clutter and know what the finished product is going to look like. And so that was 2006. I graduated in 2008, like we talked about before. Fast forward to 2011. I've got some savings after, you know, being on an engineer salary for a couple of years. And I found a home that I just fell in love with. And I think if anyone looked at it today, they'd be like, you're crazy. It was a 4-bed, 2-bath, and it had a pool in the back, in-ground pool. And it all sounds great on paper until you realize that it had just been neglected. The pool was solid black. The house had a leak over the garage. There was a sweet little bulge in the drywall over the garage where there is a leak. Every square inch needed to be updated and some sagging parts in the subfloor and foundation and stuff like that. And I looked at my realtor and I was like, this is the house I want.
We call that value add, baby.
Probably not like most 25-year-old buying their first house. But she was like, well, let me just show you around some other houses. She was like trying to shove other houses into my face. Like, take a look at this one. You don't need to, like, you know, do all that hard work that you're probably going to be doing. And so she showed me 5 other houses. And I kept finding myself comparing it to this other house and like just really like what the finished product would be like, yeah, but it's missing this bit of character. I don't like the layout compared to the other house, or it clearly doesn't have an in-ground pool in the back.
Right. Yeah.
Things like that. And so it was a short sale. I ended up closing on that one. It was a slow live-in flip. I rented out a bedroom to a colleague of mine while I was saving up every year for repairs. And so I would try to save up like $10,000 a year for flooring throughout the house, or painting every square inch, or kitchen project, or backyard, a hardscaping project, stuff like that. So every year I would just save up for a new, big, massive project. And I just waited for a storm so I could file an insurance claim on the roof. I was like, I'm not paying for that.
Smart. That's smart, man. House hacking with a value add component.
For sure. Yeah. And so fast forward 8 years later, we liquidate that property. And then after that, it's kind of true what they say, more money, more problems. I was like, what do I do with this? I'm like the world's slowest learner, I feel like, but I'm like, I just clearly generated a bunch of wealth in real estate. You would think I just immediately would just look into real estate and do stuff. But it took me a while to come to the conclusion that, all right, like investment real estate, not just like being in it and fixing and flipping, like look at investment real estate. So I came across Rich Dad Poor Dad shortly thereafter, the Bigger Pockets community, and just trying to understand like what to do with this type of stuff. And the level of capital that I was at, you know, there's a lot of questions of, you know, how much money do I need to save for my first home? And I was like, yeah, I'm in a different place. And so I immediately bought 3 single family homes within a 6-month time period. They were actually all off the MLS in 2020. I really knew what my buy box was. I was like, I want it in this county, in this Nashville sub-market. Price needs to be this. It needs to rent for this much. And then after that, it was just speed, just acting with speed. And so I closed on 2 on the same day. And then the third one was a couple months after. I took a look at my net worth calculator and I was like, how am I looking? And I really wasn't. I compared it to the trajectory that I was on based off of the timeline where I wanted to have, you know, a certain amount of passive income. And I was just like, I'm not really on track. Yeah. I wasn't really satisfied with where I was going. The conclusion that I drew in all of that was I needed more doors, but less driveways. And so initially when I started out, I was actually looking for quadplexes. And the thing that where I was really struggling with is like, I can either invest in my backyard, which has quadplexes, mm-hmm. or I can invest in a market that is remote or distance. And initially I was planning on taking on self-management. And so that I was really leaning towards, you know, it needs to be in my backyard. After 2 months of owning the first property, I was like, I'm giving this up. There's some other things in life that kind of dictated that, right? I just taken a new role. It mandated 14 hours a day of my attention. And I was like, I'm not going to compete with any other property manager when I need to like let emails and voicemails bubble up over lunch and then get to them. Or, you know, after work, it wasn't working. And so got a PM in there and like life was good. actually. Like after I got the PM, he's like, he got it leased in like less than a month. Whenever we got the third one, he walked the property with me on the day of closing. And he's like, you know, what do you want to do? And he's like, I know you're handy. And I was like, it's better if I don't do anything. And so we ended up getting a small repairs, but getting a tenant in there in 3 weeks or so. I was actually budgeting for like a month and a half of reserves for getting a tenant in there. But like, just like everyone was better than the last, right? And so doing well there. But I really wish I could have started with a quadplex. Still, the limiting belief that I had that kind of set me back, if you will, was that I needed to be close to it. Now I have three properties in 20 minutes range that I haven't been to in over a year and a half.
I know how that is. That happens.
You know, so a lot of good that did me. And so, yeah, if you want to fast forward now, we came across multifamily syndication, saw how well that aligned with the skill set that I had developed, being an electrical engineer, mostly on the commercial side of the business, mostly in sales, but also being in very technical roles, managing CRM databases, but also being on the service side of things, customer service side of things. So professional communications is the easy part for me. Managing expectations with the intent to exceed, increased amounts of transparency, all of that just kind of led me to the investor relations side. Not only that, right? But the investor relations side, plus some of multifamily syndication. Since then, I've invested in two apartment deals, one in Louisville, Kentucky, another one in the Huntsville submarket. Invested in a new development deal as well in a Nashville submarket. I recently completed a joint venture for a 55-unit storage facility, also in a Nashville submarket. So just very well invested within a four-hour drive of me. Any direction is kind of whatever I'm looking, except west. I'm not quite turned on to Memphis just yet, but I know people do stuff there, but it's such a street by street market that I feel like I got to put in so much work to understand what's going on with the market and the geography there to where it's, I don't know that I'll get the payoff that I want, but that's where I'm at now. And so I've been full time since last August. And so when I have a short term rental in Panama City Beach, we closed on that earlier this year in March. And so we have a lifestyle asset at this point. So
nice. And so why did you add that to the portfolio? Simply because it's a lifestyle?
Yeah. And I really struggled with, is this shiny thing syndrome? Am I giving into this?
I think all entrepreneurs do.
The number one mistake is you try to build too many bridges in too many directions too quickly. And I'm like, I'm trying to be mindful of that. So I've got these long-term rentals and they're doing okay. They're paying for themselves. The apartment deals I'm invested in are great. But, and we started doing direct to seller at the turn of the year for multifamily. We're getting our lead funnel. We're looking at hundreds of properties a quarter. At the end of the day, like once you get your systems and processes and team built up, people selling apartment complexes, it's not on my schedule. We're getting pretty good response rate, but it's on their schedule. And so I felt good that we had the right activity that was eventually going to lead to the right goals of more acquisitions around multifamily assets. It doesn't help that it's arguably the most competitive commercial asset class out there. And we're in a very desirable market being in around Nashville. And so to me, it felt a little bit like I was watching paint dry with multifamily. It's just like we had everything lined up. We have a pipeline. But it's, like I said, it's not on my timeline. And so I was considering other more cash-centric, cash flow assets. I had known for some time that what short-term rentals are known for is there's appreciation, sure, but there's also the number that I was given was that on average, across markets, across the entire U.S., short-term rentals earn 60% more than long-term rentals. It's all market by market. There's tons of disclaimers in there, right? But I was just like, is it really? And then I started looking at AirDNA. I started looking at Rabu. My parents are retired and they live in Panama City Beach. What's a guy in real estate do when he's bored, right? He starts looking on Zillow and poking around like, what is this trading for? What is this trading for? And so found some pretty affordable neighborhoods in the Panama City Beach market that were a block off the beach, built in 1980. And I was just like, this price point is pretty interesting compared to what I see the daily rate and just mining economic occupancy and stuff like that. And it's like, this seems like a good deal. So then I just, out of, we'll call it boredom, but I was just like, I let myself be curious. And I was just like, just, we'll see where this goes. So I think I got like three different underwriting templates for short-term rentals, walked through a bunch of YouTube videos of how to analyze properties, very quickly consumed three different books on short-term rentals. And I still think Avery Carl's book on short-term rentals published by Bigger Pockets is the number one in just kind of giving you the well-rounded ecosystem of short-term rentals, what to look for, what to avoid, but also setting up your systems, building your team, that type of stuff. But then I started looking at those properties that seemed to be low barrier to entry, but still renting consistently. They're kind of the middle of the market. They weren't intended for the 1% of the world. And I was like, okay. And then we still had money left over from us whenever we liquidated that property in 2020. So I was like, you want to try this? by the way, we have a house like near our parents, like they could stop by if we needed to drop off a TV or anything like that, but, or just have someone stop in. But I have no problem like trying something with my own capital. I know we talk about investor relations and other people's money, but it's like my tolerance for risk is a lot different than what I would be with other people's money.
Right.
There's some people where they're not that way. They're just like, hey, this looks interesting. I'll take anyone's money, whether it's mine or other people's. That's scary. I don't want to interact with people like that. But it's just like, let me try this first. So my wife still works at her W-2 job. And there is a world where we're like, if we get 10 of these, right, you know, there's a world where that offsets her income, her W-2 income. And then she's now is full-time in real estate. And maybe we start building up a property management firm. I'm not too interested in arbitrage, but if it could get to the point we're coaching people on how to analyze properties in our market and we end up managing them, right? That's kind of like what I thought. Like, I was like, if I wanted to build a business and I wanted to play entrepreneur and something else, right? I saw the path forward for that one. But right now, we're just trying, all right, let's do one. And so we've had that one since March, and July alone, I think we earned like 4 times debt service.
Wow.
In July, that went bonkers. So 31 days in July, there is one day that it wasn't rented.
Crazy.
And so
with everything that's going on.
Yeah. And I'm a big proponent of that. Other markets did have slowdown, right? Markets that you had to fly to,
yeah,
or they were luxury properties. I've heard of really, really large properties struggling. And so, but I have a middle of the market product and I have a middle of the market. Right. It's a drivable place. You can get there in 8 hours from maybe the bottom part of Kentucky, but Kentucky, Tennessee, Alabama, Georgia, like a lot of people congregate to that market. And so it's been pretty resilient so far. I'm going into the slow season, so I'm trying to be mindful that I'm probably going to need more reserves than I would normally. One of my friends that manages, and he's gone through a July experience or a January experience, but he's like, in January, it's a race to the bottom. Our plan was, why don't we live there in January? We had snow 6 times last year in Nashville. People think Nashville doesn't get a lot of snow and stuff like that, but we had snow 6 times last year. And man, I was tired of that. I was just like, again, like get out this mop or not this shovel. I got to get out this brush or something. I don't even have a snow shovel. I'm like, snow shovel in Tennessee. You kidding me? I had these things that I was like, these brushes that I used to clean my garage. I was like, it's taking me forever to get snow off the driveway. I'm just like ill-equipped to handle that stuff.
I'm sure most people in Tennessee are.
For sure. My wife is from Chicago and she's just laughing at me. I'm like, so cold. And she's like, you don't know cold.
Yeah, you don't know cold. Well, man, any tips for anyone that would be interested in that, the short-term rental, like what to look out for? Or what they should be doing that maybe they wouldn't even think of.
Yeah, the short-term rental space has been interesting. I think when it comes to, I'll give a tip for a couple different aspects of it, but one tip when it comes to underwriting is that, so if you go on AirDNA, you're going to get estimates. I guess the thing I don't like about AirDNA is it gives you the market's average daily rate, and then it gives you occupancy, 75%, 70%, whatever. And I think generally speaking, a lot of people will take those to multiply them together, times 365 and say, this is the gross income I'm going to get for my property. But when 80% of the market are luxury condos on the beach, right? Average means something a lot different than when you're buying an asset that's a block off the beach, that is not going to get those rates and command that. So if it had stuff like median rents, I'd be more interested in stuff like that. But there's so many outliers that the word average gets skewed. I also have a data scientist background. And so I'm very mindful of like, are, you know, how are things being sampled and like the using median versus average. And I'm super sensitive to outliers and how they can affect the data set. And so with that in mind, so far, Rabu has probably been superior, RABBU.
And that's online.
Yeah.
Right?
So that's where you're just putting in your address and it says, this is what we anticipate gross income to be. Plus or minus that 90%, 110%. But for the most part, it's fair. But the gross income does also include cleaning fees, because there's no way for them to take it out of the reporting and stuff like that. And so there's just a lot of holes where people could miscalculate something, especially if they are taking other people's money into something. Or so I would say, if you're going to try out anything, try it out on your own, test it for a full year, a full season before you start saying, all right, I'm going to get 5, right? If I'm listening for what are the most mistakes people make in the short-term rental space, it's that they go too big, too fast without knowing what a full season looks like, without knowing what to do when the HVAC goes out while a tenant is in there, or whenever they have a roof leak while a tenant is there and they need to displace someone. Like the oh crap moments is what people need to be prepared for whenever they have multiple units like that. So be over prepared for something like that. So that's kind of on like the underwriting side. But as far as like, I actually presented to my former workplace last month on the secret formula to how you have a vacation home pay for itself.
Oh, let's hear it.
And so I guess generally speaking, if you can self-manage, that is the way. I would argue that 99% of the front-end marketing can be automated. So for example, you get your listing in order, you get your photos in order, and then you just let it bake. All right, you're putting those things in the oven until the timer is up, and then someone is going to book something. Airbnb, VRBO, it kind of helps to be on as many channels as you can, but you can get those going. I have a property management system that syncs the calendars together. And then I have my smart locks that are on the property. My property management system takes the last four digits of whoever books, makes that the code, right? So it's easy for them to remember.
What's the name of that management software?
I use Guesty for hosts.
Okay.
And then I use Remote Lock just for like kind of my lock management system there. But Guesty for hosts should do everything you need for something like that. There's Guesty and then there's Guesty for hosts.
Okay.
So if you just search Guesty, you're not going to find the same thing. But that's pretty interesting. But it's similar to the self-storage space of like whatever software you get is going to dictate what hardware you can get because they're kind of married together and partnerships and stuff like that.
Right.
So if I was using Hospitable, I'd probably have to use different locks. I'll probably have to use Yale locks or something like that. So just be mindful of make sure you got all your pieces to the puzzle figured out. I bought the locks first. Thankfully, the PMS that I use was integratable with that. But I came to find out later that there's some fine lines drawn around what can be integrated and what can't be. And so, yeah, so if you're self-managing, like I said, I think you can manage a lot. If there's any issues, there's no way to automate that. That kind of all hands on tech. And that's where making sure your local team is, you have tier 1 through 3 of cleaners, you have tier 1 through 3 of handyman, right? People that are responsive, low cost. The cleaners need to be under market so that you can mark up the cleaning fee and make money on administrating the cleaner and stuff like that. And so that's kind of the self-management aspect of it. The part that's not really well known is the vacation home loan or a secondary home loan. So let me compare it to an investment property loan first. So if you go say, hey, Mr. and Mrs. Bank, I would love to buy a property that is not my primary home. You know, I already have a house. I want to buy an investment property. They say, okay, great. Just give me 20 to 25% down. We'll get you taken care of. A vacation home loan is, hey, Mr. and Mrs. Bank, I'd love to buy a vacation home loan that I'll be staying at occasionally, visiting a couple times a year. It's in a vacation market. It's not anywhere near my primary residence. Can you help me get into this? They say, okay, well, yeah, bring 10% down and I'll get you taken care of. That's one of those situations. And there's a lot more lender requirements along those lines. Like it has to be warrantable, which is a term dictated by Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac guidelines. So there's duplexes, quadplexes, triplexes are automatically disqualified. Everything in a condo tail on the beach is automatically disqualified. So the property has to fit a certain criteria for something like that, but you can get started for a lot less out of pocket. Think of like a $300,000 townhome that's a block off the beach. You now only need $30,000 plus closing costs instead of $60,000 to $70,000 to close on an asset like that. So lowers the barrier to entry to get started on something like that. Your debt to income needs to make sense, right? You have to be bankable, all those other things. So it's more on your personal loan than it is you trying to get like a DSCR loan based on the asset.
Well, that's handy. That's a game changer. And do most local banks offer that? Or is it more like a niche product?
I would say there's a large number of them that will. There's also one of the first. So the three investment properties that I bought here in the Nashville area, I went to the lender and I said, hey, can you give me a vacation home loan? They said, we don't fool with those. Wow. So there's some banks that won't. They're just so well established. They're cookie cutter. They say that's a little bit outside the box. I don't want to deal with it. Then there's other people that will take that on. For mine, I just chose a lender at the recommendation of the realtor. The concern was there's a lot of interesting things that happen in Florida, and there's some good old boy counties, and there's things that you need to navigate, and they didn't recommend out of state a lender for something like that. And so I went with it. I honestly didn't have a great experience with a lender in terms of like responsiveness and being proactive. And like, they're asking me for things they should be asking for the realtor. And I try to connect them and he's like, oh, you're not the client. When they're talking to the realtor, they're like, you're not the client. Like, I don't need to answer to you. And it's just like, you should be like, you should be making it as easy as possible on me. Like, what kind of service is this? So I think we'll call it an outlier experience. Now, you know, I would never recommend them. So, but still, I think generally speaking, there's a number of people that'll do it. What I'm coming to find though, after like a happy hour I went to last month, a lender was there. And so he was just like, yeah, whatever bank that's hosting this loan, they can be flexible, right? That one of the requirements is it needs to be 65 miles from your primary residence. He's like, it could be closer, right? And so there's some things where they can be flexible on, some things where they can't. And so I've heard of some like credit unions in Tennessee that will even do 5% down.
Oh, wow.
I mean, think about like $1 million cabin in the Smokies.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, if you bought it as investment property, you need $200,000 to $250,000 to take it down. If you bought it as a vacation home, right, you need $100,000 plus closing costs. It blows my mind to think that you could get into a cabin for $50,000 plus closing costs.
Yeah. And with how much cash flow these short-term rentals bring in, like that still makes sense, right? Now, if it was a long-term rental, that probably wouldn't with that type of leverage on that size property. But with short-term rentals, it still makes sense, which is a game changer.
For sure.
How many do you own right now? Currently just one?
Yeah, just one. Testing out the waters, I told myself I wouldn't get a second or a third one until we had gone for a full year.
Smart.
On this one. So like I said, I would be nervous for January if I wasn't planning on staying there for the majority of the month. Spring break starts to come online in March and April and stuff like that. And I'm a little nervous, but I think it's high school spring break in April or March. And so I can just kind of say, hey, your parents need to book this type thing. No one 21 or under, that type of thing. I think that'll kind of self-filter a lot of the hoodlums in there. But we missed spring break last market. And I was like, dang, we'd actually been making offers since December and we were under contract for three.
Really?
Before we closed on one. Yeah.
That's been a crazy market.
And then there's the fact that everything takes longer to close than you want it to, or everything takes longer than you want it to for the first of any new type of business plan or investment strategy and stuff of that sort. So it took us every bit of a month and a half to come online. And we really didn't even need to replace much furniture, but it was just like, all right, we need to go down this weekend, get this place fully stocked. Oh, by the way, we missed this thing. Oh, by the way, we missed this thing. And so we had over a month and a half. We went down from Nashville three different times, interviewed a number of cleaners, found one that we just fell in love with. We had tried a number of handymen, found one that we fell in love with. And so far, so good.
Amazing, man. So what is TB Capital Group focusing on now? What is your primary focus?
My day job.
Yeah, what's the day job?
For sure. Yeah, so we're focused on multifamily syndication. We've been doing direct to seller since the turn of the year. That really stepped up our game. If you consider a sales funnel from the top down, right, I need to be looking at so many deals to put out so many offers to get under contract for so many to close on one, right? And if I'm just waiting for stuff to come to market through Marcus and Millichap and Walker Dunlop and the small local brokerages, I'm not going to hit that number of leads that I need to offers to under contract to close. And so my conclusion after last year was like, I need to be making my own leads. And so that was kind of the impetus for us to start doing direct to seller. And so since then, I guess pretty good response rate overall, but we're doing it, I think, a little bit different than most people, I would say.
Yeah. What are you doing? Are you cold calls, mailers? What does that look like?
Yeah. I think the generic blueprint for something like that is cold call, text message, follow-up, email, maybe in a different order, but something of that variation, right? To whoever you can get, you may or may not skip trace, right? But you're using some data aggregator to understand who is the ownership group. And then you're hoping that you get to a decision maker, right? And so that's kind of the generic blueprint. It's all kind of built upon some idea of ask before you even give anything, right? So you're asking for a T12, you're asking for a rent roll so that you can give some type of firm offer. So we try to position ours as a give on the first touch. And so our first touch is an offer letter.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. And so there's a lot that leads up to that. I'll talk about the foundation of that one. But the idea is to give something first and then just have something to start a conversation. They may say, I don't want to sell this property, but I am looking to offload some other stuff in my portfolio. It's pretty interesting how that happens. Or I don't want to sell right now, follow up back up with me in 3 to 6 months. Those are some of the types of responses that we've had. And, you know, just something in it where it's like, not in a competitive environment, right? Where we're pressed for time or anything like that. It's amazing. It's incredible being a part of these discussions. But the part that leads up to this, so we're using, I'll break it down, but we're using some data aggregator of some sort just to understand inventory. And so we're looking, our buy box is we're looking for 1980 or later build. We're looking for 30 to 200 units. And from Louisville to Huntsville, obviously Nashville is in between there. And then also East Tennessee. So Chattanooga and Knoxville are kind of too good to ignore, right? They're both fighting for third in the state in terms of population. And so whenever you're considering stuff like that, I need to know what inventory is, right? So I'm looking for addresses, I'm looking for unit sizes, I'm looking for year builds, I'm looking for owners. And so that helps us understand the inventory. And then we're at the part that I think is unique. We're actually partnered with a broker. And so we say, okay, Mr. and Mrs. Broker, these are the properties that fit our buy box. Can you send us CoStar reports that give you rent comps, that give you sales comps? And so from those, you're trying to understand what are the properties that have top of market rents, right? And we pass on those, right? There's probably no, you know, very little room to add value, right? We're looking for burnt out landlords. We're looking for neglected properties, mismanagement, that type of stuff. And so if you're at the top of the market, you're probably none of those.
Right. Yeah.
And so that's kind of our quick way to disqualify stuff. And so after that, we do a little bit more digging. The sweet spot that we found is there $200 gap between current rents and market rents? That's just like a no-brainer. That's something we want to have a conversation with those types of people. And so after that, we make assumptions on expenses. We kind of have income, right? Based on what are they renting for in apartments.com, but also the report from CoStar. So we're making expenses of either a dollar amount or a percentage of the income. So for some of our markets, we can do some of our markets, a B and C class, maybe $4,500 a door, $5,000 a door in expenses is reasonable. If it gets to be older than 1980s, that needs to go up. It's just repairs and maintenance starts to go up a little bit. Or you can take a really lazy approach and just say, 50% of my income is going to be expenses, or 45% of my income is going to be expenses if you're in kind of a low tax state like Tennessee. And then from there, determine your purchase price. All right, what is my NOI, cap rate, purchase price? And so that's kind of how we come up with the purchase price. We take what, you know, probably like 90% of fair market value, and we put it out there, right? Knowing that it's human tendency to ask for more. And so even if they're saying, hey, your number looks low, it's just like, oh, okay. Yeah, we could probably really sharpen this pencil if you give us a T12 and rent roll.
Perfect.
And so it's pretty interesting. The last round that we did of follow-ups is just like, you know, there was one response we got. He's like, I value my property at $14 million. That was obviously way different than the offer that we put out there. It's like, oh, okay, well, can we get T12 and rent roll? Getting access to that is going to give us a lot clearer picture of, are they being unreasonable, or is that fair?
Right.
Could we make that work for our investors and aiming for 15 to 20% annualized returns? So yeah. And by the way, I'm not competing with a whole nother nation of people that want to get in the Nashville market.
Right. That's smart. Especially in a hot market, you got to set yourself apart. And like, to your point, top of your funnel is what needs to grow in order for you to submit the amount of offers you need to submit to actually get a deal close. You mentioned CoStar. Is that the primary source where you're getting this? Or are you using like List Source or something like that to generate the actual list you're going off of?
Yeah. So giving away all my secrets here, but this is actually a great tip for newbies and anyone that's just starting out. But we use a program called Reonomy.
Yes. Yep.
And so they're the only aggregator I've found that gives a free trial, actually. So Reonomy will give you a 7-day free trial as long as you have a phone number that is not voice over IP based and you have an email. They make sure there's no duplicates of that. So whenever your timer starts on that 7-day trial, like, you need to be exporting like as much as possible.
Yeah. Go.
The first time I did it, I exported 600 properties worth of data in an afternoon.
Wow.
And then I gave it to a VA and I said, please put this in Excel format for me. Thanks.
Yeah.
And so I got my Saturday back for $30 worth of work. You know, I didn't. CoStar, if you don't know pricing, CoStar is a mortgage.
Yeah.
Reonomy, I think it ranges from like $500 to $800. It depends on how much you want to export every month. So it varies, but we'll just say less than $1,000 a month, but still like substantial burden, yeah, you know, financially, definitely, if you want to do that. And so we've paid for that for a number of months, but really just to export everything that we wanted for asset classes that we were interested in. And so, like I said, people just starting out, you can get a trial. You're limited to 50 exports in any given map whenever you do something like that, but you can zoom in, get 50, zoom in somewhere else, get 50, zoom in somewhere else, get 50. It just becomes really, really simple to handle. So Reonomy has been our initial source just to understand what is the inventory that is in the buy box that we're looking for. If people are getting started or they're figuring out like, where do I focus and stuff like that, it has to be market first. Step one is get educated, right? How do you analyze deals? How do you analyze markets? Blah, blah, blah. What KPI should I be looking for? Population growth, job growth, median household income, median home price, right? Crime rate. Figure all that out. Figure out what market supports those criteria that you want. After you've got your market, then just build a team around the market. Like, that is the blueprint for succeeding in real estate.
Yeah.
And so, and then after that, that's where the fancy apps come in, where you're exporting data and stuff like that.
Oh man, you gave some nuggets. I appreciate that. I've had a few people come on and talk direct to seller, and it's never been like that. Like, that makes a lot of sense to first how you define the criteria and how you're reaching out with a give and not a take. I think that's important because everyone's sending out mailers or some type of cold call asking, you want to sell, you want to sell, you want to sell. I like that. And then it elicits some type of response. And then you can dig into the, well, if you want me to sharpen my pencil, you send over Rent Row and T12 and then we can get going. That's smart. I like that a lot. And so you've been doing this for about a year?
Full-time, my 1 year anniversary was August 1st. We've been doing direct to sellers since like literally Jan 1.
Okay. So we're talking about 8 months, almost full 8 months.
Yep.
Oh, that's awesome, man.
For sure. I think there's 800 properties total that are in our markets that fit our buy box. 200 properties where we've gotten CoStar reports from, underwritten. We've offered close to 70. Just the direct to seller stuff, we've put out over 60 offers and had some really interesting conversations. So one conversation, for example, was, I don't want to sell this property, but I have some other ones I want to offload this year. Come to find out, they have like 10 properties in Tennessee. They've got like 6 in the Nashville area, 2 in the East Tennessee. And we're just like, okay, like, let's keep this conversation going. Like, me and my partner, like, we actually went walking them. We went walking 2 properties every weekend for like a month. And we're just like, these are nice, like 100 plus units, like kind of B class. And are just like, these are really good. One was like a townhome community that we just fell in love with. And so we're really going to push for that one next time that we talk. But it's interesting conversations and things that you wouldn't think happen, right? I think there's a couple criticisms in direct to seller in general. One is just like, if you're offering on anything over 50 units, you're wasting your time, right? Because you're probably talking to a sophisticated investor group. But us putting offers on the 100 plus unit apartment complex is what led to more 100 plus unit apartment complexes, right? They said, hey, this is our portfolio. But so much of it can be timing. There's like 4 apartment complexes that I know of within a 30-minute drive of me where they've had buildings burned down, right? How many of those owners do you think are just like, I want out. I don't want to deal with this. Like, oh my gosh, it's crazy to think about. I was talking to a commercial insurance guy here locally, and he's like, I've had the same building burned down twice at the same apartment complex. And he's just like, we're more or less like not even making money on this property anymore as an insurance company. He's like, we're negative. We're going to have to hold him for years, like increase his rate so much. And then there's a couple also just like on the way to Nashville, there's like 2 others that I just like, I visibly saw like a charred part of a building. And I was like, okay. And my partner's like, yeah, I know about that one. There's also this other one that had a building burned down. So much of it can be timing, right? Where it's just like, if someone tells you no, and you stop there, you're leaving something on the table. And so, but also like the size, the limiting belief on size, I think, I mean, it's free marketing, right? It's free marketing, right? It's even like a form of networking to get in touch with other apartment owners and like, you know, oh, maybe we can just have a coffee, see how you got started. Like, do you need help? Like, does your son or daughter need tennis lessons? I used to play a lot in high school. Like, I mean, just there's a lot of creative ways that I think people undervalue themselves that they could add value to someone else, given that real estate business is a people business.
Yes.
You know, at the end of the day.
That's what I was going to follow up with. It's a form of networking, and that's what business or any business is about. It's not about who you know. It's about who knows you. You want to be top of mind. So that guy might say, no, I don't want to sell this property. Yes, you're looking at other ones of his properties, but what happens when he does want to sell that? He's probably going to think of you first and come to you. And that's what it's about. So I feel like a lot of people that start off direct to seller type of marketing and don't continue it is because they get so many no's and get frustrated. But this is like, yes, you can get a quick hit, but I think it's more of a long-term play that whereas you're really going to reap the benefits.
For sure.
Have you scored anything yet based off of this?
At this point, no, quite honestly, which is on one side, it's frustrating. But on the other side, like the relationship that we're building up with a broker has actually led to, I think there was like 2 or 3 pocket listings that have been sent our way. One we had access to earlier this year, and another one we are the best offer right now. So I think ask me again in 30 days and we may be under contract. So
awesome.
In terms of the relationship that's being built with the broker, like there's a lot of intangibles that come out of doing this.
One deal can pay for it all too.
Mm-hmm. And so the other counterpoint to doing this, or the other criticism to doing direct to seller in this manner, right, where you're just throwing a number out there, is if I'm saying, you know, hey, Mr. and Mrs. apartment owner, I'll buy your apartment for this much, right? Now, generally speaking, someone else would want to come in and say, hey, what would be the amount that you would walk away from this apartment and give me the keys, right? You would want to feel them out. But the criticism with me doing it this way is they're going to figure out how much your property is worth, and then they're going to go to a broker and say, hey, can you help me push price on this one? I think my place is worth this much. I have people willing, offering me something like this. It's an informal appraisal, blah, 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 blah. And so that's why we don't push price too high, right? We offer 90% of fair market value. But also the other thing is we're doing it through a broker.
Right.
So it's like we're giving them the tools that they need, even if they did want to take it to market. And it's just like, if it came to one of those situations where it's like we weren't their buyers, which is plausible, right? I got to think that there's a world where the universe gives us something else in return. Maybe not in the way that we think it is, but it's kind of the idea between around adding value and like the universe's response to doing that. And so in real estate, I would say, right, is there some way I can add value to you? Is there some way I can add value to it? So tons of lunches with people that really don't have anything to offer me, not an issue. I'll do that all day, every day, as much as I can. That's why I love investor relations. I just want to hear like where they're at, and I want to check in with them 3 or 6 months from now and say like, did you apply anything that you learned? Like, please say yes. Even if there's nothing they can do, I know there's going to be return my way in some form of, oh, I have a realtor friend that wants to invest in real estate or needs to shelter their income. They could really benefit from cost segregation or something like that. Do you know of anything, anybody that's doing stuff like that? I'm going to chomp at the bits and say, oh, I know a guy that can help them out there. And so I'm always about adding value to people regardless of what's in it for me. Same way with this stuff, right? If they end up brokering a deal and I'm not a part of it, I'm not going to expect a kickback. There's going to be some intangible way that I benefit.
Yeah, the law of reciprocity. But I feel like if you're going to direct to seller and they're then conversing with you, there's probably a good chance that they don't want to go to a broker. Obviously, you might come across a few that would, but that's awesome, man. All right, we're coming to the top of the hour. I don't want to take too much more of your time. But first, where can listeners find you before I ask the last two questions?
For sure. Yeah. Thank you so much, Sean. And this is Tommy Brandt. And so I am on Facebook and LinkedIn, and that is Brant as in B-R-A-N-T as in Tommy. And so check me out on Facebook and LinkedIn, also tbcapitalgroup.com. If you go on there, there's actually a little gift for your listeners. I wrote a book that is very data-driven and detail-oriented. Sue me, I'm an engineer, can't help it. It's the Passive Investor's Guide to the Multifamily Universe. So if you want to learn a little bit more about that or just find what I think are some pretty interesting data points on different comparisons between conventional assets to alternative assets, and then comparisons between single family, multifamily, and then comparisons between all of the commercial assets in general, I think there's going to be some intriguing information in there for your readers.
Awesome. Hey, I appreciate that. And listeners, definitely go check that out. I think I'll do the same. All right. Final two questions. First one has two parts, and that is, why multifamily to build wealth or to get you to your goal, your ultimate goals? And part B of that is, what kind of life has this afforded you?
For sure. I love that. And so I'd say it was through experience that I concluded that multifamily was the way. I know after my first 3 single family homes, I might've alluded to it before, but my conclusion after a couple months after that experience was my passive income isn't scaling effectively. My net worth isn't scaling like I wanted it to. And my conclusion was I needed more doors, less driveways.
Yep.
So I needed the scaling effect. I needed to not have to build a team around every single property every single time I get one. And so I would say, generally speaking, the ability to scale quickly and effectively led me to multifamily pretty organically, I would say.
That's awesome.
Remind me of the part B.
Yeah. Like, what type of life has multifamily investing provided you and your wife?
Sure. And I'll generalize that a little bit, but just real estate investing in general.
Yeah.
Although I am very heavily invested in multifamily, I think just 350 units plus invested in multifamily only. And but it's pretty incredible. And so the kind of life that this has afforded me, I'll just give an example. There's 5 freedoms, right? That everyone needs to be ultimately freedom. There's people freedom, people that you want to hang out with. There's geographic freedom where you can go anywhere you want. And then there's time freedom, being able to hang out with who you want to, where you want to, when you want to, and then financial freedom. And there's a 5th one, I forget it. And being financially free, being able to afford all the other 4 freedoms, right? And live the life that you want to. I'm going to put a big emphasis on geographic freedom. My wife and I actually got back from Cambodia.
Oh, cool.
2 weeks ago. We got back from Cambodia this week, actually, after being in Cambodia for 2 weeks. And so my long-term rentals were taken care of. The apartment deals were running themselves. The rest of my JV team I was interacting with, albeit on a 12-hour difference. I was taking care of the short-term rental taxes that I needed to file for, talking to tenants, albeit on a time difference. But I was managing the real estate business regardless of where I was. And so I'm well on my way to ultimate freedom. Just having freedom of geography is critical for me.
That's awesome, man. And that's really the cool thing about real estate investing is that you can tailor it to fit whatever your goals are, but also what financial freedom is to you. You can completely tailor that to it from, you know, I tell the story all the time is that when I decided to go heavily into real estate and leave finance was I wanted to create a business. First, I wanted to create the ideal life that I wanted and then create a business around that. And that involved one, obviously the money to fund it, but mm-hmm. the flexible calendar time so I could go where I wanted to go, be with the people I wanted to be when I wanted to be there. And that's hands down, that's what real estate provides. You see it time in and time again. So yeah, I agree with you 100%. All right. Last question, Tommy, if I was to give you a time machine and think back, you go back to younger Tommy, maybe the one that was just graduating college. It was tough out there trying to get a job. And since this is also a personal finance show, we talk about personal finance every Friday. What is one piece of financial advice you'd give your younger self?
This is very specific to me, but I would have taken a HELOC on that home and bought other homes, other rental properties, dead capital in my house for the better part of a decade. So that was probably the thing I would do differently had I known how to analyze rental properties, how to build a team, how to afford a property manager. That's kind of the specific thing. But generally speaking, I wasn't educated, right? So I should have been, I think at some point I was fat and happy and complacent. So I should have had put more of an emphasis on being a lifelong learner. Right. Always being curious and giving into the curiosity and but also being genuinely curious, what I think extends into networking as well as competency.
And I love that answer. Yeah, I wish I had done that earlier too. Wish I'd bought earlier and then tried to scale faster. We all wish that. But Tommy, thank you so much for your time today, man. I appreciate it. I know you're a busy guy. You shared a lot of tips and strategies that people can put to use today. And I hope they do, to your point of did you actually use it, what I told you? I hope they do. So thank you. All right, listeners, thank you for tuning in. And as always, easy doesn't pay well and instant gratification is self-destructive. So get out there, work hard for your money, but also have your money work hard for you so you can create the life of your dreams and make the world a better place along with Tommy and I. All right, catch you on the next one.
Hey, this is Sean Winslow. After being in the financial service industry for years and having candid conversations with good people just like you, I realized that so many of us are wanting an investment strategy that provides solid returns and consistent income without the bumps in the road. There's little known secret that your financial advisor doesn't want you to know. There is an investment out there that is less volatile and the returns are stronger. Get more details by going to greenbriercg.com and clicking on the free e-report. And by the way, if this show has provided you any value, then feel free to leave an honest written review and of course, share it with a friend who needs it. See you next week for another great show.